Good evening and welcome to a special edition of Arts ID. I'm Robin Pressman, and I'm here tonight with David Templeton.
Hi, Robin.
Hi.
Tonight we're focusing on theater and the spoken word.
There's so much going on, we decided to expand Second Row Center into a half-hour look at some of the new plays that are opening and have just opened here in the North Bay. First, we're going to hear David Templeton's review of the new play at Berkeley Rep. It's written by Lynn Nottage, and it's called Ruined.
And then we've got my interview with Elliot Fintichel, whose science fiction stories have been turned into a theatrical piece called We From Afar. At the same time, I spoke with Jean Abravaya, the playwright behind the new comedy, The Final Scene.
And finally, we'll hear about a musical opening in San Francisco. It's Rock of Ages, and we'll hear about the history of rock music on Broadway and an interview with one of the producers of Rock of Ages. So stay with us for this special edition of Arts ID, David Templeton's Tour of the Theater.
Theater, like any other form of art, is first an act of self-expression by the playwright. Before anyone steps into an artist's studio to study a freshly painted canvas, the painter experiences a moment of inspiration, some driving urge to express something, describe something, release something, or find something. The first purpose of art, and by first I mean chronologically, is to provide a method for the artist to scratch an itch, relieve a pain, or confirm a discovery. Theater is no different. Whatever happens on stage once the curtain rises and the audience turns its attention to the actors is almost beside the point. A great piece of theater begins with a playwright feeling something, which then turns into an idea, and then a story, and then, ultimately, a play. With truly gifted playwrights, the deeper the feeling that inspired them to create, the wider is the potential for that completed work to flow over and beyond the printed page, or the canvas, or the stage, and wash over the reader, the viewer, the audience. Lynn Nottage, whose work has earned her numerous awards, including a MacArthur Genius Award, is one of those artists. A student of American and world history, deeply curious about the world at large, and especially the lives of women, Nottage writes plays the way surgeons find the causes of internal bleeding, by opening up a subject and carefully searching through the mess until the cause is discovered. She made a name for herself with plays like Intimate Apparel, which recently ran at the 6th Street Playhouse, and won the Pulitzer Prize 2 years ago for her play Ruined, a work that stands as a shimmering example of how an artist's initial emotional impulse can be nurtured into a work of glorious genius. In the case of Ruined, that initial impulse was one of horror, disbelief, and overwhelming compassion, with little more than the idea that she would tell the stories of women living in the Congo, a country split into pieces by years of civil war and violence. Nottage visited the Congo and spent several months listening. Whatever unformed stage play existed in the back of her mind was soon pushed aside as Nottage, over and over, heard stories, upsetting, nearly unbelievable stories, all built around the word rape. Rape, she soon learned, is a weapon employed in the Congo conflicts as aggressively as our guns and bullets. The despair and anger conveyed through these women's stories shook Nottage and also inspired her. The result is a play that, while deeply disturbing, remains full of music, color, laughter, and a compassion so real and pure one can't help but be affected as deeply as was the playwright. Ruined has now come to the Bay Area, running through April 10 at Berkeley Repertory Theater in Berkeley, directed by Liesl Tommy, who staged the show three times so far, including last year's run at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival. Ruined follows several months at a remote bar and brothel run by the iron-willed Mama Nadi, who staffs her business with lost women, many of them the victims of rape. The brothel's customers are mostly local miners, along with the occasional trader or salesman, and soldiers, fighting on either side of the increasingly messy conflict for control of the region's natural resources. As Mama Nadi repeatedly explains, she may be forcing her women into prostitution, but in a culture where such women, the victims of rape, are viewed as shameful, untouchable, even to their families, at least they have a home at Mama Nadi's. The play is a cross-stitched fabric of overlapping stories as each of Mama Nadi's women seeks a different type of answer to her pain. Each expresses their pain differently, none more movingly than the sensitive Salima, who, late in the show, cries, "You will not fight your battles on my body anymore." All of this sounds, I know, like a rough night of theater, and it is. Tears will be shed, for certain, but as performed by a brilliant cast, Ruined is much, much more than just a tale of ugly realities on the other side of the world. It's the story of bruised and damaged hearts, human hearts, which find a way to continue beating and perhaps to trust again, perhaps even to love again. Ruined is an extraordinary example of theatrical art at its finest. The emotions Lynn Nottage experienced as she opened her heart to the stories of strangers have been transformed into a theatrical event that is also an act of compassion, an act of calm, quiet rage, and finally, an act of sheer, breathless beauty. Ruined runs Tuesday through Sunday at Berkeley Repertory Theater. For information, visit berkeleyrep.org.
It's Arts ID, a special edition. I'm Robin Pressman in the studio with David Templeton. And we're next going to visit two local writers who have plays opening or recently opened here in Sonoma County on the stage.
Well, I'm in the studio with Gene Aubervaya and Elliot Fintichel. So, Gene and Elliot, you're both writers and you're both actors. So I want to start off by asking, which is easier, writing or acting?
Well, for me, absolutely acting. Taking somebody else's words and creating a character.
Elliot?
Oh, I'd be hard put to choose. I mean, they're just both a romp for me until you start deciding whether what you've done is good or bad. But I just love it. It's like, it's like uncapping oil wells. Although, you know, it might not be oil or it might be Wesson oil instead of gold.
So, Gene, with acting being easier, does that mean it's more satisfying?
Oh, I think writing is much more satisfying. But it's much more terrifying also, because you can always hide behind a character. When you've written something, you've basically offered the world a part of yourself. And whether it's accepted after that or not, that's a very scary thing.
Well, right now you are both in rehearsals on shows that sprung from your written words. Gene, you've got a play that you wrote, and Elliot, the piece that you're working on with the Imaginist came originally from short stories.
Right.
So I'd like each of you to tell me what that process has been like in transforming your printed word into stage work that other people are doing.
Well, I don't know how to describe it. It's a combination of joy and actually even a little sadness, too. To see your work transformed from the page to the stage, joy when it's successful, sad when you know it needs work and it's not the actor's fault, it's yours, and it's ennobling, but it's also humbling at the same time.
Yeah, my situation's a little different because all the pieces from which this stage work comes were all originally written to be read. they were short stories, although one was written as a futuristic stand-up monologue in a crazy dystopian world, and that's done as a monologue. So it's wild to see that done and to see the person who does the monologue, Brandon Wilson, who's actually a stand-up comic, performing it as if for this audience of the future. But for the others, they had to be changed into a dramatic format to begin with. And I feel really lucky to be working with the Imaginists, with Brent Lindsay and Amy Pinto, who just have the most startling, fertile imagination, so that they're taking my stories and rendering them for stage. It's like watching a two-dimensional object just blow up into four dimensions. And I give them totally free range. They can change the words. They can change whatever they want. Because the result, I know, is always astonishing.
So, Elliot, you were nodding when Gene was talking about the sadness part of this process. Do you identify with that on some level?
Let's see. The simplest way for me to put it is that everything is absolutely perfect, and that moment before the pen touches the paper. And for a short while afterwards, it's very good, and you can prolong it by drinking lots of coffee. But then entropy sets in. You know, a day later, it's crap. 2 days later, and it's worse than crap. The best thing I've found, actually, and this is just with short stories where you submit them to magazines and so on, is not to read it yourself, even as you're typing it, and put it directly in the envelope and send it to the editor before entropy gets a chance to set in and it decays and becomes bad.
Gene, do you identify with that?
Well, I do. Mine's a stage piece, and I've been watching it, watching my material being rehearsed for weeks and weeks and weeks. There comes a time where you start to second guess yourself. You start to say, "Is that really funny? I don't know anymore if that is really funny." You start to worry that it wasn't really good in the first place. You know, that kind of thing. You work really hard to make it good. And then you go, "I don't know anymore."
Do you ever have the opposite, where you write something that you think, well, this is okay, but it's not as good as the next joke, and then you realize in rehearsal, actually, in the mouths of the actors, it's pretty funny or pretty great?
Well, that's the wonderful part about it. That's the most thrilling part about it, is when you have written something that you think is good, and then you see it actually executed, and it works. And what's even better are the times that you just described, that you thought something was maybe going to be supportive of a line that you've written, and an actor comes along and adds their talent and their depth and imagination and creativity, and suddenly you see something that's so much more of a whole than you envisioned. And that's why, even though you start with a playwright's words, it's still a collaborative process, and it will always be a collaborative process.
You know what's interesting with the Pulitzer Awards? Those are judged purely on what's written on the page. In most cases, they prefer to have never seen a production of that, the Pulitzer Committee. Mm. They read the script, and they determine whether it's working on the page, and then they decide what's a worthy or unworthy recipient of this greatest prize. Mm. And yet, everybody who talks about theater work views the script as just kind of a bouncing off point to the real magic, which is what's on stage.
Oh, yeah.
And yet clearly the Pulitzer people are saying it's the opposite, that the purest version of this play is what's on the page. Oh. How do you guys feel about that?
My understanding is quite different from that. And I mean, it's the same as music. Unless one is oneself a really accomplished musician, you can't understand a piece of music from seeing the score. And if you read the score literally as it's written, it's not going to be music. It'll be horrible. to cases with my pieces, for example, they really change. They have to change texture when they're on the stage. And I have the strange experience not only of having written it and seeing it perform, but I have some parts in the play. So here, like in Forbidden Planet, this world that I imagined is looming up all around me. And I'm seeing at one point Santa Claus being shot up by a Kalashnikov in one play, in Santa Side. And in another one, in We From Afar, an alien is gangbanged by females of the future. And I mean, these are matters of a phrase on a piece of paper, but it takes on quite a different aspect when it's happening around you in real time and real space.
One last question for both of you. Do you think being actors makes you a better writer?
The most that I ever learned about the art of writing was from participating in improvisation workshops, learning how to be responsive to the material that was coming before me from my own hands and how to respond to it and to the questions that it posed one after the next freshly so that one continually surprises oneself.
I think it enables me, being an actor, enables me to take on each of the characters and to try on each of the characters and explore what they would say in their own individual voices.
So as you're getting ready to watch the premieres of your shows, what's going on? How would you describe your emotional state?
I feel like a kid being let loose into a playground, and the playground is looming up around me as Brent builds it.
I'm scared.
That both sound like perfectly sane responses to the creative process.
Gene Abravaya's The Final Scene is now running at 6th Street Playhouse. It runs through March 27th, and you can find out more about that at 6thstreetplayhouse.com. Elliot Fintichel's We From Afar opens this Friday at the Imaginist Theater Collective in Santa Rosa, and it runs through March 26th. You can find out more at theimaginist.org. Next, David Templeton takes a look at the history of rock music on Broadway and gives us a preview of the musical Rock of Ages opening tomorrow night at the Curran Theater in San Francisco.
Oh, what a beautiful morning. Oh, what a beautiful day. I got a beautiful feeling. Everything's going my way.
The phrase Broadway musical, it conjures certain immediate pictures in one's mind, specific sounds. When someone says Broadway and musical together, you can almost hear 100 years worth of chorus lines, tap dancers, possibly some cats, cowboys or crashing chandeliers, and probably singing orphans.
It's a hard knock life for us. It's a hard knock life.
Of course, 40 years ago, with the introduction of genre-pushing musicals like Jesus Christ Superstar, Hair, and Godspell, the sound of the Broadway musical began to shift reluctantly forward as the music of the streets and clubs began to rock and roll their way into the Broadway musical form. It has not been an easy transition. Broadway proved stubbornly resistant to rock and roll. Though Hair was nominated for a Tony for Best Musical, it lost to 1776. Jesus Christ Superstar and Godspell weren't even nominated. In 72, the retro rock musical Grease was nominated, but it lost to the since-forgotten rock musical Two Gentlemen of Verona. After 72, and a brief reemergence in 75 with the musical The Wiz, rock was shoved way off to the sidelines. There would not be another major rock musical on Broadway until 1993, with the stage adaptation of The Who's classic album, Tommy. For the next two decades, with very few exceptions, Broadway belonged to Annie, Evita, Sweeney Todd, and the Phantom of the Opera. When a show did include some recognizably rockish tunes, as in the musical Dreamgirls, they were safe, easy-listening, light rock tunes. Throughout the 80s and 90s, as big hair bands like Journey, Bon Jovi, and REO Speedwagon brought their own sense of larger-than-life theater to the rock and roll arena, the Broadway musical continued to be dominated by the same band of composers, Stephen Sondheim, Kander and Ebb, and Marvin Hamlisch. Even Andrew Lloyd Webber, whose superstar had blazed the trail for rock musicals, was now pumping out musicals steeped in tradition, composed to sound like they belonged in a Broadway theater. Then, in 1996, everything changed, and this time, Broadway was ready. Jonathan Larson's Rent not only set box office records for a rock-themed show, it became the second ever rock musical to win the Tony for Best Musical, and then it went on to win the Pulitzer Prize for Drama.
Viva la vie bohème!
Since Rent, Broadway has seen a furious flurry of musicals built around rock music, from original shows like Hairspray, Spring Awakening, and Passing Strange, to nostalgic jukebox creations assembled from well-known chart-topping favorite shows like Mamma Mia, Movin' Out, and Jersey Boys. In 2009, two huge rock musicals were nominated for Tonys, Next to Normal, about a family struggling with mental illness, and Rock of Ages, another jukebox show built lovingly from the biggest, loudest hits of the 80s.
I wanna rock! Ah! I wanna rock! Ah! I want to rock! Ah!
Next to Normal won the Tony and snapped up its own Pulitzer, while Rock of Ages, which comes to San Francisco this week for a six-week run, has done for hair metal music what Mamma Mia did for the songs of ABBA. Featuring the loudest, rowdiest, face-meltingest onstage band in the history of the Great White Way, Rock of Ages appears to have ripped the lid off the Broadway musical once and for all. The very next year, last year, 2010, saw a whole string of inventive rock musicals exploding all over New York. History was made again when the Tony Award nominations were announced. The list included the Green Day musical American Idiot, Fela, a hip-hop-fueled biography, Million Dollar Quartet, about a chance meeting of four seminal musical legends, and Memphis, which won the Tony, a show about the late 50s birth of rock. For the first time ever, all four shows nominated for Best Musical were rooted to their cores in rock and roll. On Broadway, where it traditionally takes 20 years for music to reflect the sounds of the moment, the past has finally caught up with the present. Original cast recordings may never be the same. Janet Billig-Rich is one of Rock of Ages producers. With the show ready to open in San Francisco, she spoke with me about the rock and roll revolution currently taking place on Broadway. So I've heard it said that on Broadway, even when there's been a rock musical, the Broadway rock sound is different than the real rock sound. It's Broadway orchestras playing in a rock style rather than real rockers playing the way they would in a stadium show. So when you first began working on Rock of Ages, how did you approach the problem of making sure that the music was authentic?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say about rock and roll being authentic, because that has always been from day one. Our goal is making sure the music was authentic, because if the music doesn't work, nothing's going to work in Rock of Ages, because we so rely on this is a rock show, and it's really an authentic, a love letter to the authentic 80s Sunset Strip rock. So that has always been our biggest concern, is that it sounds great and it's real. And it was really difficult to do, because you get, you know, once you get into the Broadway world, you're working with all sorts of Broadway people, and they want to Broadway-fy everything. So, you know, a rock guitar turns into some sort of like tinny Broadway show tune guitar. And we had to work really hard to keep our vision alive, because it's really easy to turn a rock thing into like a show tune. And it was, you know, we ended up, our lead guitar player on Broadway is actually the guitar player Night Ranger. Our lead guitar player, who you'll go see at the Karin Theater, is actually a touring rock musician. Our drummer in the band that you'll see at the Karin Theater is from David Bowie's band. So we really went out of our way to fit the square peg in a round hole of rock musicians working on Broadway.
What is it about 80s music that you thought belonged on Broadway?
The answer is this. Those songs, the songs of the 80s, were really like a smidge away from a show tune anyway, where they're big stories with big emotion. And that's really what works. Is so what Chris D'Arienzo did was he created a story that used these songs to help propel the characters. And the songs really do that. They're really like deep and thoughtful.
Well, as you of all people know, 80s music is often mentioned along with the phrase guilty pleasure. So, as a producer of the reigning 80s rock Broadway extravaganza, I'd like to ask you to tell us what it is about 80s rock that is pleasurable on the guilty pleasure side, and what about that makes people feel guilty?
Why are they guilty pleasure songs? Because they're just fun. They're not meant to be, you know, anything more than what they are. And I think that's what makes people think they're guilty pleasures.
I think people say guilty pleasure as a way of apologizing.
Right, like apologizing for loving Poison or apologizing for loving Whitesnake. I don't know why people have to be so apologetic about it. And you know what's hilarious and what's so funny is as the trajectory of Rock of Ages happened, you know, we've had many like friends and different friends from the rock world come visit. And it's always like my hippest, coolest friends who go in like at arm's length and like it really is like, oh, well, I'll go see the show because, you know, you're working so hard on it. It's so important to you. But I'm not going to like it. And they come out like they're the first ones cheering on their seats, you know, with the lighter in hand, losing their minds. Tom Morello, Rob Zombie, like losing their minds, loving the show.
Well, things do seem to be changing on Broadway. There are suddenly a lot of rock and roll shows that are doing really well. Last year at the Tonys, for the first time, all of the nominees were rock-themed shows.
Well, I think Rock of Ages was absolutely part of the cultural zeitgeist of, you know, rock on Broadway. You know, you can't have the conversation with Rock on Broadway in 2011 and not talk about Rock of Ages. So I feel like we're part of the conversation. You know, did we like start the zeitgeist? Did we light the fire? I don't know. I think there was a hole and we filled it. And I think people see the success of that. You get, you know, when the Tonys take notice and your audience takes notice, so it's audiences and critics, when they could both enjoy it. So I think people who are creating shows think, well, if that connected and American Idiot connected and even, you know, Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson, like these are rock shows and, you know, people are loving them. So that's what we should create. You know, there's a market for it. Let's give the market what they want.
Rock of Ages opens tomorrow night at the Curran Theater in San Francisco and runs through April 3rd. For more information, you can visit bestofbroadway-sf.com.
Moving now from rock to hip-hop, we'll spend the next half hour looking at the rise of hip-hop as a musical and social phenomenon. It's a special presentation from the Modern Language Association. Here's What's the Word?